This week on Behind the Lens, New Orleans City Council weighs whether or not to maintain the current property tax rate as city officials warn of a potential $25 million budget shortfall. And charter school operator KIPP New Orleans holds several pre-approved charters. We'll review the pros and cons of these so-called shelf charters. Also, over 36,000 formerly incarcerated persons in Louisiana regained the right to vote this year. But advocates consider the registration process to be a form of voter suppression. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
This week, Mayor LaToya Cantrell's Chief Administrative Officer, Gilbert Montaño, appeared before the City Council's Budget Committee to make the case for maintaining the current property tax rate. Michael Isaac Stein covered the meeting. Michael, what is the current property tax rate, and what reasoning did the city give for keeping the rate the same?
Off the bat, there's really been no final decision made on all of this. And so the backdrop here is that this year was a quadrennial reassessment year. And basically what that means is parish assessors, ours is Assessor Errol Williams, are required every 4 years to reassess the value of every property in the parish. So that fell on this year. And on those years, the city council, as well as other authorities that collect property taxes, so we're talking about the Orleans Parish School Board, the Sewerage and Water Board, all of them are required to do something called a rollback. And basically what this does is it decreases the property tax rate to a level that would keep revenue consistent with last year. Because usually in these reassessment years, you see a lot of properties going up in value. So basically, that mechanism is to make sure that, you know, if there is a huge, you know, reassessment bump, that, you know, there's not necessarily a huge increase in individual property taxes that people have to pay. You know, and as it's been widely covered this year's reassessments were quite dramatic. You know, you're seeing some properties with 200, 300% increases up to, you know, nearly 1,000% increases of what their previous value was. So it's been a fairly controversial year. So you do this rollback, but then the authorities that receive this tax, including the city council, then have to decide whether or not they want to roll forward. And so what a roll forward does is that basically keeps the property tax rate the same as it was last year, which would mean huge property tax jumps, you know, for anyone whose property was reassessed at a much higher value this year. With that as the backdrop, the Cantrell administration is requesting that the city council do that roll forward. So keeping the tax rates the same, which would lead to higher property taxes for a lot of residents. And their main justification here is that there is going to be a $25 million budget gap next year, basically if they want to sustain last year's budget.
Why is the city expecting to be short $25 million next year?
So there's two figures that go into that. The first figure is recurring expenses that had been previously paid for with one-time money. So that's, you know, somewhere around $20 million. And the biggest portion of that is $13.5 million in police raises that were approved under Mitch Landrieu's administration but had been paid for through the lease agreement for the World Trade Center to be turned into a hotel. But that revenue isn't there anymore, so they have to find, you know, another source for it. The other part of this equation is that the administration is expecting a decrease in short-term rental tax revenue, someplace between $2.5 and $7.5 million. I think the council raised a lot of questions about that short-term rental number when it was brought up. You know, the math on that, for example, there are just some assumptions there that the council had a problem with. So we'll see if that's actually, if the budget hole is actually, you know, that large when we actually get into budget talks, you know, starting next month, but really heating up in November.
And as you said, it was widely reported when the property assessments came out, and many homeowners, property owners in the city did get letters saying that their assessments had multiplied. How are people supposed to be able to absorb that sort of tax increase?
Yeah, I think that's the council's main point. Council members on the budget committee at this meeting were, you know, very hesitant, if not completely, you know, rejecting the idea of a full roll forward. I mean, you could also, by the way, just another part of this is that you can do a partial roll forward. So you can go someplace between the roll back and the current tax rate. But, you know, again, yeah, that was the main thing. You know, they were saying, yes, okay, we understand that this is a budget hole, but a lot of our residents simply cannot absorb this cost and remain in the city. And you know, Councilmember Kristen Palmer made the point that it's not just homeowners, that, you know, often these tax increases, they'll fall down to renters in the city. So it's really a money issue for everyone that lives here. And so I think what the council was saying is that if there's a budget hole that needs to be filled, we need to look at every option we possibly have to find that revenue. And the council has actually been holding meetings over the past month or two, you know, since these controversial reassessments have come out, looking for other sources of property taxes aside from residential that they can kind of get at. And so one of those, you know, was the industrial tax exemptions. Councilmember Moreno identified, together with an organization called Together New Orleans, identified two of those industrial tax exemptions that had expired in 2017, but had still been considered valid by the assessor. And so the assessor has since taken those off the rolls and expects that to bring in $700,000 next year. They're also, you know, there's been a big focus lately on nonprofit tax exemptions. Critics have said that nonprofits are allowed to exempt too much property. So, for example, property that they use for a commercial purpose unrelated to their nonprofit mission can be exempted here. So that's another source of money that they're looking at. But yeah, again, overall, they're saying, you know, even if we do have to find this $25 million, you know, I think some council members are feeling that they simply cannot ask that of their residents right now.
What did Gilbert Montaño say, you know, could possibly happen if they can't make up this $25 million projected shortfall?
Right. So that actually was a pretty controversial part of the presentation. So, you know, they got down to the bottom of the presentation and said, you know, here's what could happen if we don't do the roll forward, if we don't find this money. And the options on the table were pretty dramatic. You know, it included cutting 500 plus jobs from City Hall, across the board, you know, 13% salary cuts for city employees. You know, there was talk of cutting, you know, fire department and EMS workers. And the city council actually kind of took issue. Helena Moreno asked if, you know, basically accused it of being a scare tactic. Because at the end of the day, if there was a $25 million budget hole, there's, you know, for example, there's an $18 million reserve fund that they could draw from. There's other parts of the budget that you can kind of squeeze that, you know, if you were actually making $25 million in cuts, it wouldn't just be blanket 500 employees or something like that. So we talked to Gilbert Montaño, the CEO, after the meeting and asked him why, you know, they would use, you know, those terms. And basically what he was saying is that puts it into real terms for the public. He was saying, you know, 500 employees, that's something that everyone can kind of grasp on the magnitude of that, while things like drawing on reserve funds or squeezing certain parts of the budget might not resonate as much. So for him, it was a tactic to kind of dramatize the effect of not rolling forward. But I don't think it was very effective on the council, at least.
What kind of deadline is the city council on to come up with a solution for this situation?
The big deadline is December 1st. So December 1st is when they have to finalize a budget by December 1st. I think that meeting is expected to be November 27th. But by then, you know, when you write up a budget, you need to know how much money, how much revenue you're working with. So by that time, they're going to have to figure out whether they're going to do the roll forward or the roll back. Otherwise, you can't really have a reliable budget. So, you know, by the end of November is kind of the deadline we're coming up against. And in that time, the council has said they're going to keep looking for ways to raise money. Councilmember Palmer in particular said she's ready to put down legislation, you know, immediately to try and find this money. So they have a little bit of time, more time than usual to do this type of planning. So we'll see what they come up with.
And has this whole conversation and this whole issue brought any criticism on the assessor's office in terms of, you know, how they can possibly assess properties at 200 or 300% of their value within a matter of 4 years?
Right. Yeah, there definitely has, you know, coming from the council, certainly. I think the framing that's been coming from the city council has been kind of this juxtaposition. You know, on the one hand, you have skyrocketing, you know, property assessments for residents. And at the same time, the council is pointing to a lot of businesses and nonprofits that might be getting away, you know, with not paying their full fair share. And so the question is, how much effort is the assessor putting into reassessing residential values versus how much effort is he putting into chasing down tax dollars that might have been left on the table from corporations and different businesses and nonprofits as well? So, yeah, I think that juxtaposition has been important for the council's argument in the past couple months.
Separately, you also reported this week on an issue at the convention center that deals with contracting prison labor to build a fence. What's the story there?
So, yeah, this week at the monthly meeting of the governing body of the convention center, they voted on a contract with Prison Enterprises. And Prison Enterprises is a division within the state's Department of Safety and Corrections that basically sells products and services produced by inmates in Louisiana prisons. And like you said, this contract was for a wrought iron fence, $183,000. And during the meeting, one commissioner in particular, Commissioner Bonita Robertson, you know, basically said, I have a problem with this. You know, these prisoners get paid cents on the dollar for this work. The lens ended up looking at what Prison Enterprises actually paid. So if you look at it, prisoners can either do work for a reduced sentence or for money, and that can range anywhere from 0 cents an hour to 20 cents an hour. You know, for some prisoners, for whatever reason, are ineligible to work for a reduced sentence. If that's the case, the prisoner would have to work 3 years for no pay at all before they get the introductory rate of 2 cents an hour. Commissioner Robertson brought that up as an issue, so they started discussing whether they were going to pass it or not. The interesting thing was that during this conversation, it comes out that the fence has actually already been built. And regardless of the outcome of this vote, the contract is valid and the convention center has to, you know, oblige by the terms of the contract. And the reason for that is that a resolution from about a year and a half ago allows the convention center staff to sign contracts up to $250,000 without board approval if it's related to their linear park project. And so that's a pedestrian park that they're trying to build along Convention Center Boulevard. So they ended up voting, you know, against ratifying the contract. But what happens next is pretty interesting because, you know, like I said, the contract is already valid and the fence has already been built.
How did that happen? How can you even try to, after the fence is built, forget about the contract being signed, but the project is completed? How does this happen that you try and revisit it?
Yeah, I think this story brings up a couple issues. You know, one is the you know, morality of using prison labor. And the second one is, you know, all of these contracts that appear to be going into effect without board approval. So, you know, the convention center is dealing with tens of millions of dollars in contracts every year. You know, what we heard at the meeting from the staff is that to keep those going, to keep change orders going, to get continuations on services, they need to be able to do certain things without board approval. You know, the question is, how much is that being done? What is the total value in these contracts that are, you know, are being signed without board approval every year? So it brings up a few issues, and we'll be, you know, keen to report on that going forward.
Thank you, Michael, for helping us keep them honest, and thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
KIPP New Orleans is the largest charter operator in the city's school district, managing 7 schools at 8 campuses. And as it prepares to take over the charter at John F. Kennedy High School, KIPP will come close to hitting the district's enrollment cap. Lens Education reporter Marta Jusen has been following the story. Marta, let's start by simply explaining what an enrollment cap is as it pertains to New Orleans' charter system.
Sure. So New Orleans has in their board policy a cap of 15%, which means no charter group can enroll more than 15% of the city's K-12 students at one time.
And why does this enrollment cap exist?
I think it's kind of like a market control if you think about New Orleans as a choice system. And so it exists both, you know, to make sure there are lots of operators and choices for families. And then on kind of the flip side, it exists so that, you know, should the biggest operator in the city fail, it's only 15% of the kids, you know, the district only has to find a new school for 15% of the kids. It's not like half of the schools are being run by one nonprofit group.
And another interesting point that you brought up in your article, I thought, was that the cap kind of limits any one school from having too much influence over the board.
Yeah, I talked to Doug Harris of the Education Research Alliance, and he makes the point that if a group controls, you know, a certain amount of the dollars that are coming out of the district and, you know, the actions that are going to be happening, they're going to have a lot more political sway over the board. It's actually, I think, kind of funny because you could already argue, like, all of the charters banding together have a lot of sway over the board since we're an all-charter system. For example, anytime the district is going to issue a new policy, they have an agreement that they will provide that policy to charter school leaders before they provide it to the public. So you can already see little hints of that, but they don't seem to be geared to one organization that has a, you know, a massive amount of power as opposed to it kind of being spread out.
So even if we had as many schools as possible maxed out at 15, there would still be around 7 charter operators in the district. How many charter operators are there and how many students are there?
Right now we have about 40 different nonprofits operating charter groups, and they range in size from, you know, KIPP New Orleans operates 7 schools at 8 campuses to we have several single site charters, some who are running schools as small as like 100 kids. Across the district, there are about 44,000 students, and for the purposes of this story and the 15% cap, that's actually not including the 7 Type 2 charter schools. So because they're state-run, they're not included in, you know, kind of this market control mechanism, but there are, you know, another couple thousand students attending those schools.
So we have 40 charter operators, and KIPP, you said, is the biggest, and it's actually gotten pretty close to that 15% cap, especially now that it's taking on the charter for John F. Kennedy High School.
Right. So they're increasing their student population, presumably. We don't actually know yet because they don't take an official count until October 1st, and they won't get Kennedy until next year anyways. But we do assume that their share of the market is going to increase and that they're going to be approaching that 15% number. The district projects them to be just below 14%.
After all of the news this past spring that you reported heavily on with the problems at Kennedy, Kennedy's charter operator decided that they could no longer run the school after this year. So how did this process go so quickly that Kennedy has a new charter operator sort of waiting in the wings?
The district kind of uses a system that they don't necessarily call it this, but I have for years called it, you know, a charters on the shelf kind of system. These are pre-approved charters. And that terminology is pulled from what the recovery school district used to, you know, call them shelf charters, because these are pre-approved. They're not yet used. And then if you come into a problem or kind of an emergency situation like Kennedy, you're able to act more quickly because there are available charters to be placed somewhere. And so I talked to several board members and, you know, former RSD superintendent Patrick Dobard, and they said that they all really like this system because it, A, allows the district to act fast if needed, and B, it gives parents and community members kind of a, you know, a menu of options when it comes to who they want to run their school. I think some people on the other side would say this takes away the board's ability to approve a charter for a certain site, and they might not like that, but kind of the resounding thought on this was that this is better for the community. They can meet the charter groups before they weigh in on who they like, and then they can voice their opinions to Superintendent Lewis, and then he can go ahead and make that decision.
So basically, KIPP had, you know, paperwork for approved charters. You just have to fill in the name of the school.
Essentially, they had, in the fall of 2018, they got 3 charters approved, so they have 3 of these shelf charters waiting and ready to go. So now they're using one for Kennedy, and I believe they might actually have one more. So they may have had 4 total going into this fall. But essentially, it's a school that's ready to start. And if you're KIPP and you're, you know, a network that knows how to do this, you can do that pretty quickly, as opposed to, you know, a new group that's just starting up and you're probably going to be figuring out a lot more things.
Like a blank check, just right. Sort of fill in the name of the person that you're giving the check to. It's already written out and ready to be cash, essentially.
Exactly.
So is this a good thing? I mean, obviously KIPP is a large operator. KIPP is an established operator, and it allowed some expedience in getting this Kennedy situation taken care of. But do most people see this as a good thing?
I think people do like that kind of menu of options. There is, you know, when KIPP was chosen to run Kennedy, I went and I asked the district. I said, oh, like the board didn't vote on this. You know, how does that work? And they explained to me that the board only votes on charter approvals. They don't vote on what the district is describing as a siting. So kind of like your blank check thing, you're filling in the location. So I think definitely for Kennedy, it was good to be able to do that quickly. And then I spoke with Orleans Parish School Board member Woody Koppel, and he thought actually, like, he's thinking expand these shelf charters as big as you can get them, hopefully with high quality operators. You know, he was like, I'd love to see another Ben Franklin High School open. So, but also he acknowledged that some of these smaller operators who are running A or B rated schools might kind of be maxed out. So maybe that's not quite an option, but he thought it would be good if some of those operators, you know, could figure out a way to get ready to take over schools that, you know, every year we have a few F-rated schools that end up closing, it seems like. So if they could kind of step in there.
And while there is this enrollment cap, KIPP being the largest operator, the largest charter operator in the city right now, what is the benefit to allowing them to be so big?
So when I was talking to Doug Harris, the Tulane researcher, he brought up the point that, like, when you have larger organizations, they have better economies of scales. They're more efficient. You know, they get better deals on bus contracts, so they're saving in areas like that. He also did a study a few years ago that found that the bigger charter networks are spending a lot less percentage-wise on administration, because if you have all these single-site charters, you know, you're duplicating the CEO salary multiple times. So certainly the larger networks can kind of get better deals, have better economy of scale, and that is one reason that you'd want to let networks get a little bit bigger. And also, I mean, he made obviously the clear point that if they're doing really well, we want them to grow, right? If you had some network that was all A-rated schools, you'd probably let them keep going, because we want all our kids to be in A-rated schools.
Yeah, so do you think there's any chance that if KIPP gets up against that 15% cap, do you think there's any chance that they would reevaluate that, given the fact that, you know, if it is a successful charter operator with successful schools, that you want them to continue to grow in their success?
Yeah, so I think it's going to be really interesting for KIPP, because they're going to come close to that cap next year. They also have several charter renewals next year, and so that's going to be a big year as far as grades go. And I know right now there's 7 schools. I believe they have 5 Cs, a D, and a B. So they're, you know, pretty in the middle of the road there. So when grades come out in November, it's going to be really interesting to see whether or not they, you know, attempt or have interest in getting any more schools before they kind of figure things out for the next cycle of renewals.
And ultimately, you know, as you said, this enrollment cap is all about making sure that there's an open market or some kind of competition, at least in our charter landscape, as well as ensuring choice for parents.
Right. So there are several small operators out there. I talked to the CEO of Plessy Community School. They're a very small arts-based school. And, you know, she said she thinks that their small size and their arts-based curriculum is what really interests parents. And so, you know, I don't know if that's necessarily something you can replicate at scale. But those are the things to be thinking about when you're thinking about, oh, you know, what should the cap be, or should the cap exist?
Kind of that balance between a big box store and a smaller mom and pop, you know, that you can't necessarily replicate the mom and pops, because once you do, they become the bigger conglomerates. And there is a benefit to having that option in the market.
Right. And the, you know, if the bigger if the bigger players are more efficient, then, you know, they're probably seeing different gains that we're not seeing in the mom and pop. So it is definitely about, you know, creating a balance here.
Marta Jusen, thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
In March of this year, some 36,000 people who were formerly imprisoned had their voting rights restored in the state of Louisiana. Voice of the Experienced, or VOTE, is an advocacy group for formerly incarcerated people and has been working to inform people of the change in the law and help them navigate the cumbersome registration process. I sat down with VOTE's founder and executive director, Norris Henderson. Norris Henderson, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. I mean, this is a very important issue, and the more people I talk to, the more our message get out.
Yeah. So the reinstatement of voting rights for formerly convicted persons, the law passed in 2018. It went into effect earlier this year. Let's just start for people who haven't been following the story. Why was it so important to give voting rights back to previously convicted persons?
Well, the main reason is the question becomes, why was voting rights ever taken away? Because voting, and I tell people all the time, that voting is not a privilege. Voting is an inalienable right. I mean, folks are citizens of this country. And what's really striking about this, that people don't kind of like follow this stuff. These are kind of like Jim Crow policies, Jim Crow era policies that were put in place to suppress the black vote. And so there's been this groundswell or this wave that's moving across the country that's been questioning that theory. Why do people lose their right to vote? It's not a condition of the sentencing structure that sends them to prison. No statute in the state of Louisiana sentences a person that, okay, well, you stole $5, and as opposed to the 6 months you're doing in jail, I'm going to send you to lose your right to vote. A judge can't do that, because there's no criminal statute that allows a judge to do that. These are just collateral consequences that people put in place.
So the law was that you couldn't vote if you were physically incarcerated, but you did get voting rights back after you had finished your probation or parole, which for some people turns out to be a very long time. And so the law that was changed was now that you get your voting rights back after you served 5 years of parole, your voting rights are reinstated.
And not necessarily probation, because what was so awkward about this is that in Louisiana, not like other places, you can be on parole for the rest of your life. Somebody who get convicted, say hypothetically, of armed robbery carries 99 years. Say the person stay in prison 30 years. Well, for the next 69 years, that person is on parole. So really, they're disenfranchised for life. And so we looked at that and said, no, this is wrong, completely wrong. And so we kind of like start pushing the envelope. And so this last year, we were able to go into the legislature and get the right to vote established for folks who are on parole, who otherwise would never get the right to vote back. And so for folks who are actually on parole, the compromise was, well, as long as they've been out 5 years or more, they can register. Probation is a different thing. Probation is people who never go to prison. Probation is people who walk in the court, may get a sentence, and they're kind of like, their sentence is kind of like deferred. You go home. And so for those folks, they're eligible to vote the minute they walk right back out of court. The biggest thing has been educating people about it, because, you know, when people read about what's going on in other states, folks are actually disenfranchised for life, you know. And so when people look at that, they think, well, you go to prison. I even have folks say, man, I can't register because I've been in prison. I'd be like, no. That is not true. Years ago, that was true. That is not true. In some states, that's true.
How has your organization tried to reach out to people and let them know that the law has changed and that they are eligible to register to vote?
We have a pretty active social media presence. We actually have a campaign, so we have purchased roughly, I think, like 17,000 yard signs that educating people that if you're on probation or parole, you actually have the right to vote. We have them scattered throughout the state. We actually have 70 billboards throughout the state. We actually have a big push through the Players Coalition that they got the NFL to actually give us a grant to educate people around their right to vote. And so we have been using all the resources that were available.
And someone on your staff was telling me also that you have an arrangement with the Department of Corrections in terms of sharing information about people who are getting out of prison, and therefore you can directly reach out to them as well.
Well, one of the things was that because the Department of Corrections is responsible for providing the information to the Secretary of State's office and to determine who is eligible and who is ineligible. And so in order for our outreach to do it, to make it that much easier, that we have partnered with them through probation and parole, because that eligibility letter has to come from probation and parole. And I want to kind of give them a big shout out, because they have been very, very much involved in helping us getting the message out. And some places a little more, it's 21 different probation and parole districts, and some districts are kind of like gung-ho. Some of them are still trying to figure out what their particular role is. But for the most part, probation and parole has been very, very helpful in helping us get the message out. We have a newsletter that we send out to everybody that we have identified to educate them. And so the only real challenge for us is just hard to track how many people who've actually engaged. Because, you know, here's the other thing about that, too. Folks kind of like move on with their lives. And sometimes the neighbors don't know what their history is. And so sometimes folks just don't come right out and just say, oh, that's talking about me. And they do it surreptitiously, you know. And so to the extent that we can get as many people engaged in this process as possible, that's our objective.
You know, I imagine that when you're coming out of prison that there's a lot of things that you need to do. There are a lot of things that you need to decide, file, you know, in terms of updating identification, maybe updating an address, finding work, all of the things that I'm not even thinking of. So where does registering to vote fall on the list for most people? I feel like that might not be a priority, but maybe should it be?
That is a real challenge. No, that's a real challenge. That's a real life challenge, because folks are like, I need a job. And so registering to vote becomes secondary. But our education around it is about, this is how you'll get access to all those things, because you're in a position now to start holding people accountable who control those things. It's like the campaign we ran years ago to ban the box around asking this question about, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Because we were able to educate people about that and the importance of the power of their vote, that we got it done through the city council here within the city, and we got it on the state level. But that came because people actually made the connection. Your inactivity contributes to your challenges. But nobody's never took the opportunity to engage these folks, never took the opportunity to educate them about the power of their vote, or why it's so important to vote. It's more than just voting for a candidate. Civic engagement is bigger than that. And so, no, that's been our only challenge, in the sense that, like, when we're talking to people who have come in contact with the criminal justice system, their priority is, if they don't have it, is food, clothing, and shelter. And so, you know, being their shoulder in the ear for them, helping them navigate that terrain, it's like, this is why it's important that you register and vote, because now you have a voice in this whole process.
So it seems like there's a few hurdles, right? Informing people, encouraging them to prioritize registering to vote. And then it's not as easy for a formerly incarcerated person as it would be for a non-formerly incarcerated person to register to vote. Tell me a bit about the process.
And that's what one of the real challenges is, because the Secretary of State's office kind of like threw this little wrench in the wheel. And it's like person has to go to probation and parole to get an eligibility letter. Then they have to go to the registrar's office to register. And if folks are not being educated about that, you know, folks been here and know so often that the first time they get turned away, they're just going to like, I'm done. And so if they go to the registrar's office to register and don't have the letter, well, you can't register. You got to go get the letter. If they show up probation and parole and they get some static there, it's like whether or not they're going to follow through. And so one of our challenges has been, one, we have somebody at probation and parole kind of like all day, kind of like helping folks when they come through to explain to them the necessity of getting the eligibility letter. And don't get deflated because you don't get it today. You may get it tomorrow. But that condition was placed by the Secretary of State. Corrections just wanted to do, let us just upload the file, who's all eligible, send it to you, and if their name is not flagged inside your system, register them to vote. So I'm kind of like of the impression that this is just a subtle way of voter suppression by complicating the process. Because if DOC is saying Norris Henderson is eligible, and he puts me in the database as eligible, what this piece of paper is going to do? Nothing. All the piece of paper is just another verification from the same entity that already has me in the database. It saves on the paper costs. We stop cutting down trees, you know? And so so the only thing is like, well, who's not invested in this? Because it makes DOC, who has all of the data, knows when you're going to be released, when your eligibility date, when you become eligible based upon your release date, and can just press the enter button, whoop, and they have to do that every quarter. They have to do that anyhow by law, sending to the Secretary of State. So what's the challenge? And here's the other thing that we kept trying to explain. If a person walks into the voter registrar's office, it's obvious they're not under all of incarceration. Yeah, that's great. But they created this, and that's meaning they, not corrections, the Secretary of State's office, push for this additional, as they say, security, so we can know if these people are eligible. Well, if you just type their name into the system, DOC already have them flagged one way or the other, you know? So we just saw that as an impediment. And so we are still looking at that. We got our legal team looking at it, because some people are having challenges. You know, they're showing up at one place, another place is sending them somewhere else. And like I said again, it don't take much to discourage people about a process that some of them don't see through fruition. They don't see the end game. And we've been tracking. We actually have a stack of complaints from folks that we have turned over to our legal team. To kind of like start looking at this and look to see if this is something systemic that is happening, or is this kind of like just this little one-off, somebody just got the wrong information. Hopefully it's just a one-off, because I wouldn't want to think that in, you know, 2019 that people are still trying to suppress people's vote.
I do have a call into the Secretary of State's office. I haven't heard back from them yet, but your organization has a few complaints about the way this is going. Do you think are they not being as proactive and helpful as you think they should be?
Right. I don't think they're being proactive at all, because if they wanted to be proactive, they wouldn't have created the hurdle. You know, his job, primary job, is to educate the public about their voting rights. And when he said in a committee hearing, when it was trying to see, well, how's everything going? It's because between June of last year, when the legislation got passed, and March, there was a committee hearing to determine what kind of progress we're making. And when he boldly said that his office didn't have no money and didn't have a budget to educate people around it, that kind of like signaled to us then that this wasn't important to you. And so from that day, we've kind of like been using our resources to do it. It's not that, I mean, it's something that we're mission-driven to do, but that isn't something that we should have to do. But I'll be kind of like interested in the responses that you get back from them about why they are not really proactive in trying to make this happen. If you go to probation and parole, you're going to see a big old sign up in probation and parole notifying everybody walks through the door. Hey, man, yo, guys, y'all got this newfound right restored to y'all. You know, I'm telling y'all to take advantage of it. But at least they're announcing it. You know, we are fortunate that the registrar's office here is kind of like receptive to what we're doing. And, you know, doing voter registration drives with us and everything else. That should be a given across the state. Every registrar's office should say, hey, check this out. We know there's a new populace out there that can register. We need to connect the dots with y'all to help us find those folks. That hasn't happened.
We have a big election coming up this fall in a couple of weeks. The governor, the entire state legislature. There's only so much time left to get people registered to vote. But on top of this important election, there's another nationally important election next year. So what are your hopes between this fall and next year in terms of getting people registered to vote?
I think this campaign, because we have passed the deadline to register for the October 12th primary, but we're still registering people because there's going to be a runoff. There's a lot of, you know, 2-3 horse races that's going on. Most of them probably going to go to a runoff. And so we're steady registering people round the clock, you know, that, hey, you may miss the primary, but you can participate in the general election. And so this is kind of like just to kind of like get people's feet wet. Our target is next year to make sure that we have done everything we could to register as many people who became eligible. Because here's the other thing. Every day, somebody's going to become eligible. So that's what we was telling the Secretary of State. Why this impediment when every day somebody's going to be hitting that 5-year benchmark, somebody going to come out of Tulane and Broad who just got a probation, who's going to be eligible? Why create the unnecessary paperwork, you know? But no, we are actively doing this. We are launching a national voter registration campaign probably early February, March, to get ready for the fall elections, because the fall elections are going to be very exciting. I mean, fall election for the state of Louisiana, every judge in the state of Louisiana is up for re-election, every prosecutor is up for re-election, and the vast majority of sheriffs are up for re-election. This is an ongoing process, a year-round process until we feel comfortable enough that we have educated the multitude of people that when they walk out of one of these environments, that they understand what their potential could be and what their right is to go and register and vote.
Norris Henderson, Executive Director of VOTE, which is Voice of the Experienced. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, no, thank you. I mean, because I tell people all the time, the more we can educate people about the process, the more successful we can be.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, please consider supporting nonprofit journalism in New Orleans. Go to support.thelensnola.org and make a donation today.